Hi there, I'm Marianne Lozano, president of the Broadleaf Board of Directors and the conference chair for the 9th Annual Broadleaf Writers Conference, to be held September 21st and 22nd at the Decatur Library in Decatur, Georgia. Our list of speakers features 12 amazing authors, 6 agents and editors, and is headlined by the number one New York Times bestselling author, Mary Kay Andrews. Through March 31st, we're offering an early bird special on registration, giving you the opportunity to attend both days for the one-day price. This will be the last chance to get this deal before registration opens officially on May 1st, so take advantage now. To register today or to learn more about the 9th Annual Broadleaf Writers Conference, I hope you'll visit our website at broadleafwriters.com. See you this fall!
Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of Right Now, a podcast on the craft and business of writing presented to you by Broadleaf Writers Association, based in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm your host, Zachary Steele, and on today's episode, I'm joined by activist, storyteller, and the author of I'm Not Dying Tonight, Why We Fly, and the incredibly powerful book based on her viral video, How We Can Win, Kimberly L. Jones. Hey there, Kim. How are you doing today?
I'm doing grand. How are you?
I'm well. You know, things trucking along and trying to stay busy.
Good. Same.
But, well, I wanted to get you today to talk about storytelling largely. We'll cover a few other things as well, but I've known you for a while, and I knew you first as a storyteller, stage performer, you know, stage oral storyteller. Mm-hmm. But you have since co-authored 2 novels with the equally fabulous Keely Siegel. You have a work of nonfiction that's out now. And of course, you have the history of oral storytelling, which does include I consider the viral video being a form of oral storytelling, even if it was an in-the-moment kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, when you're looking at a story, since we want to start in the beginning, what is your typical route? Are you working with a scene that makes you want to build a story around it? Are you working with a character that you want to tell their story? Or do you write to a theme, or is it a little bit of this and that?
For me, it's always the story, right? So I am not a character-driven writer. I am a story-driven writer. So I am thinking about the theme that I want to tell is always like directly beside the story I want to tell. And then the characters, I let them introduce themselves to me after the fact. So mm-hmm. I always have like story ideas first. I have a story, and then I start thinking about plot. And then while I'm thinking about plot, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to infuse the theme that I make sense for it. And then the characters just like find themselves as I'm figuring the story out. And then I start giving them names and stuff like that. But yeah, I definitely am always thinking about story first. And I'm very heavily influenced by like real world events, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like Law and Order ripped from the headlines kind of person. Yeah. Even if it's not a direct specific story that has influenced me, is something that's going on in the world. It's a conversation that I've had, that kind of thing. And I find even as a reader, I'm drawn to that kind of story, because like one of my favorite YA novels, actually one of the novels that led me wanting to be a writer, wanting to be a YA author, was Tara Alon McVoy's Criminal. Mm-hmm. And because I know that that was based on like an actual event that took place. So yeah, I'm just always like drawn to like, you know, real life occurrences.
Would you say that that's kind of an extension of your activism, or is your activism an extension of wanting to write about those stories?
I think my activism is an extension of wanting to write about those stories. I think even since I was a little girl, I was a storyteller. I remember every summer I would spend with my grandmother. My grandmother had a farm in rural Illinois, and I would spend summers on my grandmother's farm. And one of the first things she would do, because she knew I needed that to get through the summer, is mm-hmm. she would always buy me a new journal and a new set of books. And that's kind of how, you know, I spent a lot of time outside because, you know, we were outside kids back then, a lot of time outside. But when I was indoors, I didn't really watch a whole lot of TV. I read my books, I wrote in my journal. And so as I got older, one of the things that happened when I got older was that my mom, I'm the youngest of my siblings. And so my mom would like take me to the library on Saturday mornings to entertain me, because the closest person in age to me is my sister, who's 6 years older than me. So I didn't really grow up with like a playmate in the house. I kind of almost grew up, not like, I won't say like an only child, but I didn't have like, my siblings are all very close in age, so they all played with each other and I didn't have anybody to play with. And so one of my favorite things to do on a Saturday morning was my mom would take me to the library. And the library that was nearest our house in Chicago was a library called the Carter G. Woodson Library. So it was named after Carter G. Woodson, who is the founder of Black History Month. Well, when he founded it, was Black History Week, and then eventually became Black History Month. And so because it is like, it is one of the largest collections of African-American books, all has been, even back then in the 80s, it was like one of the largest collection of African-American books. And so, like just like picture books and different things like that that were not accessible in a lot of places were at that library. And so I discovered all of these people, County Cullen and Mary McLeod Bethune, and all of these like amazing Black people in history that I only had learned about in the pages of these books. And so I think in loving their stories, and you know how you are a kid, you love the thing that gets you attention, loving the attention that I garnered from being like a 10-year-old who could tell you all about the Harlem Renaissance, you know what I mean?
Right.
And loving that, it's like, that's what I wanted to do, was to continue to tell real life stories, which made sense to like grow into activism. Even that viral video is really, like you said, it's really me telling a story. It was really me telling the story of walking through a historical experience and finding a thematic way to do it. So yeah, I just think my love of story fed me wanting to tell these stories, me wanting to make sure that the least of them were heard.
I'm a little tripped up by imagining a young Kimberly on a farm, and so I think on one hand I'm like kind of like out of place, but also like perfect, because she's out there telling stories, and like John Lewis's book where he's talking about preaching to the chickens. I just imagine you out there telling your stories to just cows. Are like, what?
To the strawberries. I used to talk to the strawberries.
Oh, they probably grew really well too. Well, you talk about story being the primary focus for you. So there are various elements of a story, or also known as story beats, things like the catalyst, the inciting event, you know, act break, plots and characters, all this kind of stuff. And do you keep that framework in mind as you're writing, as you're constructing the story, or is that something you may work with after the fact in edits?
No, I am a hardcore plotter, a very hardcore plotter. And so I know people are like sometimes surprised to hear this, but I still use all of my craft books when I'm writing.
Really?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely not a pantser. I tried that route before. That is not my ministry. I have so much respect for pantsers. I don't know how they do it. But yeah, no, I'm a thorough plotter, and I still use all of my craft books when I write. And no matter what I'm writing, whether I'm writing an op-ed or a novel or a speech, or a screenplay, I am constantly being reminded of all of that structure. And because I'm using my craft books to write everything that I've ever written, a craft book was like a participant in the crafting of it.
Is there a favorite book that you have?
Oh yeah, I love the whole Save the Cat series. So yeah. I use Save the Cat writes a novel. I use Save the Cat for screenwriting. Right now, more recently, I've been writing some holiday films. There's a craft book called Writing the Perfect Hallmark Movie. I've been using that. As a screenwriter, my favorite book that I always go to is How to Write a Movie in 21 Days. So those are a few of the ones that I use, but you know, I also like adapt to what it is that I'm writing. Like I'm writing a graphic novel right now, and I found several graphic novel writing books online, and so I'm using those. And of course, you know, I still play around with form, even though I use my craft books, but I just use them as the foundation. And then once I use the craft book to get while I'm drafting, but then when I'm in rewrites and editing, that's when I cease to use them and start trusting my gut. But I use them to get the first draft down.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm totally with you with the plotting side of things. I am very often a extremely detailed outliner, even putting dialogue and stuff as it develops, as a scene develops. And I'm working on a new novel, and my publisher had asked me for he said, I would like you to give me a detailed outline. I said, okay, now keep in mind that I'm already writing a detailed outline. So how detailed do you want? He said, put it all in there. And I sent him a 12,000 word outline. It was extensive. So I feel you on, that. Well, you are undeniably a presence. When you take the stage or when you are in front of a camera, you are all in, and in a way that is captivating and engaging. And from a storytelling standpoint, if we just look at the oral part of it right now, how rehearsed are your presentations in that regard? And I don't just mean that from the storytelling, but I mean like the tone and the movements that you take.
Everything is very intentional. And it's almost as if though when I'm doing something live, whether it's like I'm giving a speech or like even just fun stuff like what Vanya and I used to do at YATO at Georgia Center for the Book, I'm thinking about it. I was like, I it's funny. No one's ever asked me that question. And it's funny you asked that because I always wonder, like, are people able to notice that I'm like thinking as I'm up there, you know? And I'm hoping that they're not, but you just,
no, yeah, jumping in, I you'd never look like you're thinking. And that's why I was wondering, because so much of your presentation itself becomes the story. I mean, it's like it's all encompassing, and that's why I was curious if you spent time working on that.
Yeah, no, I definitely, as I'm on stage and I'm live, I'm thinking about what's next. So it's like anytime there's a beat or a break, I'm thinking about what the next segment could look like. I'm thinking of like some funny quip that could come next. But I think that is rooted in my improv background. So I went to high school at the Chicago Academy for the Arts and studied improv in great detail there. And then I went on and I studied improv comedy at Second City in Chicago. And a lot of people don't know this, but I was a circus clown. And so I went to clown college, and we take a lot of improv classes at clown college. And then I've been a member of several like improv theater groups when I was younger. You know, 20 years ago or something, but I was a part of a lot of improv groups. And so I think that's what it is. I think it's the skill set that I garnered from studying improv comedy that informs the way I am on stage. And I just use all the principles of improv, like the classic theory of yes and. That's like the first tool that you're taught in improv, is that to keep the story going, it's always... And again, once you know the rules, you can break them. You know what I mean? But it's knowing the rules give you the foundation to let you know when and how you can break them. But the kind of general rule of improv is what we call yes and. And so it's like, if you say, I'm a Braves champion, my thought should be, yes, and also I saw you play that time and blah, 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 blah. Because the moment I like combat your thinking, you're like, I'm a Braves champion. And I'm like, no, you're not. I've thrown off the ability for the story to grow. But if I yes and it, then the story has some place to go. So I'm thinking about that in my mind all the time. So like when we're doing YATL, if Vanya says some like funny thing or introduces this new thought, my next thought is how can I, it's a story building, right?
You're
my
building,
next thought
right?
is how can I build on what she just said?
Okay, so does that that's fascinating. I love that. Do you utilize that when you're writing? You know, when you're
Oh,
building a
yeah.
story, it's like, okay, so I've got this scene and I've got this character and they're doing this or they're talking about this. Okay, so yes, and now what are they doing, kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's always what I'm doing. And it's funny because the first chapter I always write in any book is the last chapter. I write my last chapter first because I think about it after I do like an extremely crazy detailed 10 million word plot. The first thing that I write is the last chapter. I want to know exactly where I want to land. And again, as the story shapes itself out, I have to go back and, edit it and make adjustments to it and that kind of thing. But I feel like if I know where I'm going, that's what helps me to build on it. So it's like I write that last chapter first, so I know the roadmap of where I'm going, and then I'm doing exactly what you're asking. I'm just building on. I start then at the beginning, and I'm just constantly building to get to that end chapter. And so that way, I don't hit too high of a peak at the wrong moment because I know where I'm going to. And I know that last chapter is going to be the drop off after the climax. And so I'm just like, okay, so I'm going to build this up as high as I can, but I also have to think about when I get to that height, I'm thinking about what that last chapter is. How does it drop back down into that?
That's cool. I like that. As mentioned, you have co-authored two novels with Keeley Siegel, and what is that process like when working with a co-author? I know when I sit down to write a novel, it's all me. So I mean, I'm building the entire story. What was the process that the two of you undertook, and how did that influence the way you go about telling a story?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about the way in which Geely and I write is that we write these like alternating chapters, these leapfrog chapters. What it does is it does allow us to kind of like work independently in the sense of like we're not writing within the same chapter. Like I've talked to other friends who co-author books and they don't have a dual narrative, so they are having to like figure out how to write this story together. Whereas with Geely and I, that's not really the case. We write in these alternating chapters. So she has a character that she's taking primary responsibility for, and I have a character, that I'm taking primary responsibility for. And so we just, again, that whole yes and, we're just like building. That seems to be a theme here. It's like we're building on what each other last wrote. So if Geely would write a chapter of like with the first book, Dying, like Geely would write a Campbell chapter, and then I would read it and then pick up from it, pick up on the last segment, build on it to write Lena's ch next chapter, and then she's doing the same thing. But again, Geely and I also are extreme. Even when we write together, we're extreme plotters. So that's the part that we do together. It's like we plot the book in its entirety together, sitting side by side. We found that we did not work well with like sending each other Google Docs and stuff like that. So we just schedule out writing time together. When we're writing a new piece of work, we definitely schedule at least 2 to 3 writing retreats where we just go. We don't even have to leave the city. Like we do it in Atlanta and we go get an Airbnb and we lock in together. And so that we can, so then we are sitting there side by side crafting out the plot. And then we can go off kind of on our, in the first book at least, we kind of went off on our own. And then I'd write a chapter, she'd write a chapter, I'd write a chapter, she'd write a chapter. We had a really severe plot that we were working from, I mean, that we were working from that. Now, the second book, While We Fly, we didn't do that. We wrote it the same way that we plot. We sat side by side and wrote in each and wrote all, both of the characters together because we in the first book we felt like the girls were so polar opposite, had such different lived experiences, even had different dialects, that it was very important for us to have two separate writing styles, writers' voices on that. But our whole point for the second book was that these girls have had almost the exact same lived experience, and that there's a moment that happens when they realize that they are different, but they have had the same lived experience up until that point. And so we wanted their voice to almost sound the same for a good chunk of the book. And so we did it that way. And we have a short story in an anthology by Laura Silverman called Game On, and it's the same kind of thing. Like, for that one, we didn't even have alternating chapters. It's just one story that incorporates these two girls. So this is the first time, that was the first time we had to do it that way. And we just treat it like we plot it, but we have to do it in person. Like, I don't send her stuff and then she sends me stuff and then we share a Google Doc. No, we just like sit down next to each other, brainstorm. I'm sitting next to her. We know each other's specialty. Gilly is really good at description. So it's funny because even when we're writing in the same story, we still take on different jobs. Gilly is masterful at description, at interiority. I am the queen of dialogue. So I write most of the dialogue and the stuff that we're doing, and she's writing the descriptions. Gilly is brilliant at making you feel like you're in a place and smelling it and touching it and that kind of thing. So
that's awesome. Yeah, you, yes, and building on that, mine was always but why, and I'm starting to see that they're actually the same thing, because I mean, you know, for me it's always like, okay, character is a bank loan manager and he's unhappy in a job, okay, but why? And this is just, you know, how I get to character building as much as I get to story, because it forces you, where yours is forcing you to build on, mine forces me to work backwards, and and that helps me develop the story as well. It's very, very interesting to hear that. So your viral video, How Can We Win, obviously got a lot of attention, including to all the way to like Trevor Noah and, you know, various appearances that you, which I would love to have a conversation on what that was like, but we're going to focus on, the book that came out of that, which is How We Can Win. And, what was that transition like, taking something of a moment and turning it into an entire work of nonfiction that was very, obviously the themes were very important, and as was the call to action?
Yeah, you know, I called How We Can Win, I call that my social justice Forrest Gump. And the reason why I call it that is because in that moment, that 6-minute speech that I gave was a culmination of those moments that I spent at the Carter G. Woodson Library, my after school program at Operation Push in Chicago, my after school program at DuSable Museum, all the things I learned along the way at school, my own lived experiences, the atrocities that I've seen Black people face. And so I felt like if I was going to blow it out into a book, that's exactly what I needed to do, was take all of my personal lived experiences and walk the world through a cultural lived experience of being Black in America. And so that's what I did. I'm like, that was my snapshot journey, because the first two lines when I first started the Monopoly analogy actually come from a speech by Reverend Willie T. Barrow, who used to be the right hand to Reverend Jesse Jackson. And she was one of my mentors when I went to after school programs at Operation Push in Chicago. And she had written this article in the Defender newspaper, which is still going. The Defender newspaper is one of the oldest Black owned businesses in the country. It started in the early 1900s and it's still going. And so she had written this amazing article in the Defender about why slavery happened from an economic standpoint. Like, her purview was that, it, you know, you have to always follow the money because it's, you know, it's rooted in economics. And so my eighth grade teacher, Miss Lumpkin, whom I love, I still talk to, knew that I had a connection to Reverend Barrow and gave me that article to recite as a speech in a oratory contest when I was in eighth grade. And I came in second place. And I remember being so mad that I came in second place. I was like, I really felt that I should have been first place. But I realized now in retrospect, I was laying down a heavy conversation for a 13-year-old in that speech. But I had carried that speech like in my spirit then for 30 years. And so when the right moment came, a piece of it came out. And then I yes-and it and used the framework of what she had talked about in that article to build on it. And so for me, seeing the juxtaposition between this is my lived experience versus walking alongside the Black lived experience. And so that's the approach that I took to write the book, How We Can Win. I'm like, I am going to walk people through my life and my lived experience, and in doing so, talk to them about the Black lived experience in America. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's why I, so that's basically how that got built out. And that's why I call it my social justice forest film.
Okay, yeah, no, that's great. No, the video itself, the Monopoly talk was so obviously powerful and well constructed. But the thing that reached me in that moment, aside from just your passion, was the relatability of the idea. You know, that you really built out something that was something that I didn't have to understand the cultural significance of it to understand what you were saying and what it would be like to play. And so being able to take that and make a very relatable journey, something that we can identify with in your nonfiction book, is such a wonderful tool for storytelling, you know, to make it as relatable as it is. So I imagine part of that must have been somewhat therapeutic for you.
Oh no, for sure. For sure, for sure. It was cathartic to write that book. I always say that I don't feel like at any point in my life now I need to write a biography ever because of that book, because I feel like that did it.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
right.
That's like all the biography I need in the world. And then I want to get back to doing what it is that I really want to do, which is tell other people's stories. Mm-hmm. Like the next like 2 to 3 projects that I'm working on, in every space, an op-ed that I'm writing, my new book, and the new screenplay that I'm writing are all me telling other people's stories. And you know, the interesting thing is as a reader, I read a lot of like fantasy, dystopian, sci-fi. Like as a reader, I want to escape the world, but as a writer, I want to tell true stories.
Yeah. You have, as I mentioned, 2 novels, work of nonfiction, and you've been a storyteller. What have you learned through all of that that has benefited you, has changed you as a storyteller?
I realized, I guess the biggest lesson that I've learned, and this is more like how I was thinking when I was kind of a newbie writer versus how I think now, is that I never try to write to market. I never try to like pay attention to what's hot, what's selling, you know, looking at publishers' marketplace and seeing what, you know, editors are purchasing and things like that. I just try to write the stories of my heart. And I feel like if they are meaningful to me, that first of all, if they're meaningful to me, they will come off authentic in the world. And then secondly, if this is a story that I needed for my soul, then there's going to be other readers out there who need this story for their soul. And especially when I'm writing in the children's space, I write the books that I needed as a kid, the stories that I needed as a kid. And so I feel like they will find their audience. Like I never think about like what's hot, what's selling. It's just what story do I want to tell? And let me do my best job at telling it. And if it finds a place, great. If it doesn't find a place, that's okay. I still got it out of my soul and system. It's funny, Geely and I have another book that we wrote that, you know, we went out on submission for it. Nobody wanted it, but I'm still glad that we wrote that book. It was still, you know, a song and a story in our hearts that we wanted to tell. And we told it, and if nobody saw it but a bunch of editors and our agents, that's all, mm-hmm. you know, that's okay too.
Right, right.
But yeah, I just write whatever I feel in my heart. And some of it is successful and some of it is not. I've had New York Times bestselling novels. I've had complete flops and everything in between. And it's like, it's all okay.
Mm-hmm. I envisioning, you don't need story ideas for me, but I'm envisioning a great story now. This young girl growing up on a farm, you know, practicing her storytelling on animals and strawberries, but her real dream is to go to clown college. And
I love that.
Yes. And then she gets to clown college and you have all the experiences there, but obviously it's going to lead to something much bigger, you know, like
I don't know.
Imagine, imagine an activist clown. That's what I want. I want an activist clown. Write that.
Activist clown. I love that. I'm gonna do. You know what's so funny? I do have a story though. I think you would like. I have a short story that is on Amazon. It was my first attempt at like trying to publish something, and just basically, you know, self-published it through KDP. This is years and years ago. I think I put that story online in like 2012, 2013, something like that. So probably 10 years ago. So just in terms of like writing style, I look at it now, I'm like, oh God, this is bad. But that, you know, that's a pre me having gone through the process of being properly edited and things like that. But anyway, it's still there. It's still available on Amazon, and it's called Grandma's Hands. And it's set on my grandma's farm. And it's like a little magical short story that I wrote about this young girl, and it's me basically, about this young girl on her grandma's farm and like walking in the fields with her grandma, and her grandma being part of like a coven of spiritualists, and how they bring her ancestors back to life on this land. And it's called Grandma's Hand.
All right, well, I know what I'm doing when we're done here.
I'm warning you now, it's horribly written, but it's cute.
Yeah, well, it will be part of my afternoon for sure. Well, before we run out of time here, if we took a Kimberly Jones storytelling 101 approach to this, and you were giving advice to writers who want to learn more about storytelling, or just want to know something from you, what would that advice be?
The best advice I could give is to know that the first draft is not going to be great, and that writing is just rewriting. Don't aspire to be a great writer, aspire to be a great editor.
All right, my dear, I appreciate your time. And
my pleasure, anytime.
Love talking with you. Hopefully we can do this again soon sometime. But
yeah.
For those who are not aware of you, where can they find out more about you?
You can find me on Instagram and TikTok, and it's just my full name, Kimberly Latrice Jones.
All righty. All right. Well, thank you very much, and hope to talk soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right. Bye, Kim.